Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Happy Easter, or as President Joe Biden and the White House in Washington put it, Happy Trans Visibility Day, the latest stage of Joe Biden's determined effort to throw the election to Donald Trump in November. And it's rare, you know, but sometimes some people don't wake up from anesthesia. Benjamin Netanyahu is currently in a state of being anesthetized pending an operation for a hernia he didn't know he had until routine medical examination today made an operation tonight inevitable, inescapable, ineluctable, and if you believe any of that, I have a bridge here in London that I could sell you going cheap. And I've just called on the Speaker of the House of Commons to recall Parliament from holiday to discuss the sensational shock news in the pro-war Observer newspaper today that the British government's own lawyers have advised them that Israel is acting in breach of international law and that therefore ipso facto any and all assistance given by the British government to a government its own lawyers consider to be acting as an international war criminal makes them an accessory after the fact and could lead to their incarceration behind bars in Belmarsh prison, perhaps. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, as Betty Davis once said, because this is the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, it's looking like I'm the people's prime minister. Who would be the UK's best prime minister is the topic of the poll this evening. 50,000 people have voted, and I'm only announcing it now, right at the beginning of the show. And well, so far, it's a landslide for me. Not a scientific poll, but nonetheless quite a straw in the wind that virtually nobody at all considers Sir Keir Starmer as the best prime minister Britain could have. Happy Easter. Christ is risen. The resurrection has always inspired Christians around the world, hundreds of millions of Roman Catholics in particular, have fastened on the hope of the resurrection. On Good Friday, inaptly called the saddest day of the year, Christians believe that Jesus Christ was crucified on the demand of the Pharisees, the Jewish establishment of the time. Pontius Pilate wanted nothing to do with it. He washed his hands, famously, of the whole matter. But the ruling elite amongst the Jewish people at the time demanded the death penalty for this rebel, for this outlaw, for this man, this Palestinian Jew who believed in equality, who believed that we should not do unto others unless we would like that done into us, who believed in feeding the multitudes with loaves and fishes that he miraculously procured, who could walk on water, who cured the sick and healed the lame. This great revolutionary figure, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, was put to death on the Friday that we now call Good Friday. But the resurrection followed swiftly. And that kind of thing is what has kept me motivated. in more than 50 years in politics. The belief that even in the darkest hour, the dawn is not far away. That even in the worst adversity, that a phoenix can rise from the ashes, to mix my cultural metaphors. I believe in Jesus. I believe in his resurrection. I believe that he is the hope of the world. But you don't have to. It's entirely, of course, a personal matter. But I believe in the judgment day. I believe that all of us on the last day will be judged according to what we have done in and with our lives that God gave us. I believe that we'll be judged on that which we did not do, but ought to have done. And that too is a mainspring of my political and moral philosophy. You don't have to. You can believe that the man currently under anesthesia in Tel Aviv this evening, Benjamin Netanyahu, will not pay for his sins, will not pay for his crimes. He may evade the hammer of justice in this life, but you'd have to be a pretty hardcore atheist to believe that this man, Netanyahu, will escape eternal damnation for the crimes he's been committing, not just since October the 7th, but indeed throughout his entire political career. But he's not unique. If he dies this evening under anesthetic, and I'm religiously precluded from wishing that upon him, if he dies this evening under the surgeon's knife, he'll be replaced by someone who will make no appreciable difference at all, at least not in the medium term. He may, as a result of Washington maneuvering, be prevailed upon to cease the most horrific of the fire, perhaps not invade Rafah, although they are bombarding Rafah from land, sea, and air, an all-out invasion might be averted. To cease the worst aspects of these mass killings that are taking place around the bread vans, which when they arrive are surrounded by starving Palestinians. And every time it happens, day after day, night after night, the Israeli occupation force in Gaza opens fire upon them, killing 10, 20, 50, 60, 90, and hundreds in the worst cases. I just watched a picture of the Rajab family in Gaza City, a family that I know. Yes, a family that I know. The whole family massacred, lying there in the garden against their garden wall. What conceivable justification anyone could adduce for such cold-blooded massacre of an entire family? It's very hard to understand. It's even harder to understand how politicians in Western countries can continue to offer their friendship to a state which is daily, hourly, carrying out such obscene massacres. And yet they are. The entire front bench of British politics, the Conservatives, the Labour Party, and the Liberal Democrats, the entire ironclad consensus for Netanyahu and his actions since October 7th appears so far to be untested. Of course, Labour, under pressure from my by-election victory in Rochdale and the prospect of it being repeated in scores of constituencies across the country, are having to revert to ever more weasel-worded falsifications to, A, disguise what they were saying over the last 6 months, and B, to try and pretend that they're calling for something different now. But they are comprehensively failing. Huge demonstrations continue to take place, as they have every day, every week in the United Kingdom over the entire period of almost 6 months. The signs in the elections are that Labour is going to pay a high price for its treason of the deeply held convictions of a huge swathe, a big percentage of its core electoral vote, at least if there's any justice that is. But the whistleblowers are now emerging, and those whistleblowers are whistling a tune that may prove very deadly indeed to the British political class. The pro-war Observer newspaper today revealed a recording of a Conservative minister telling a Conservative audience in a private meeting that the British government's legal advice from its own law officers was that Israel has been and is in breach of international law, of crimes against humanity, of war crimes, of breaches of the Geneva Conventions, and plausibly, according to the ICJ, crossing the threshold of genocide. Now, you may say I'm not shocked about that at all. And you'd be right. It's obvious that Israel is breaking international law. It's obvious that the British government knows that it is, but is continuing to give arms, intelligence cooperation, the rights to fly in and out of Britain and of our base in Cyprus, even in the knowledge that those war crimes have been systematically carried out over a period of almost 6 months. That's obvious. What is not obvious, and what could be a game changer, is that as soon as the British law officers put in writing their considered legal judgment to ministers, that those ministers are now acting out with the law, because, of course, it is a crime in Britain to be assisting someone who your own legal advisors have adjudged to be in breach of international law. That means that each and every one of the government ministers responsible, principally the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, and the Defence Minister, are themselves guilty of the crime of being an accessory to war crimes, to crimes against humanity. And they will not be able to rely on the defence that they were unaware of Israel's conduct crossing the threshold of these group cluster of crimes, because the prosecution will say your own lawyers told you so. And so I have called upon the Speaker of the House of Commons, member of the Labour Friends of Israel, Lindsay Hoyle, to recall Parliament from its rather long Easter holiday and to allow the House of Commons to discuss this leaked legal advice and to question. Well, we can't question the Foreign Secretary because, rather unhelpfully, he's not a member of the House of Commons, a point I highlighted in a recent speech I made in Parliament about the missing Foreign Secretary. At a time of grave international crises, multidimensional, across multi-continental conflicts, the elected members of the British Parliament have nobody to question except a rather foppish junior minister by the name of Andrew Mitchell, who's a fine fellow, who's a smart fellow, who's a very hard-working fellow, because he's having to do his own job as well as David Cameron's job before Parliament, at least. But he's not the Foreign Secretary. The buck doesn't stop with him. The decisions are not made by him. And therefore, questioning him is of rather limited efficacy. But that notwithstanding, the Speaker of the House of Commons has a duty now to recall Parliament with this breaking news, this deeply important and serious news. And so if you are in Britain, I want you to bombard your own Member of Parliament with the demand that Parliament be recalled from its long, long Easter holiday so that we can debate this matter. I started out telling you that Joe Biden inexplicably chose Easter Sunday, the day of Jesus's resurrection, a hallowed, the holiest day of all for Christian people, to rebrand Easter Sunday as Trans Visibility Day. I've got nothing against trans people. Visibility didn't seem to me the major problem that they had. Everyone knows that they exist. And when we see them, I don't often myself, but when we see them, they're pretty visible. It was a provocation by Joe Biden to rebrand Easter Sunday as Trans Visibility Day. It was a spit in the eye of the Christian community, and one gathers that there are quite a few Christians even now in the United States of America. Biden sometimes claims to be one of them, claims to be a Roman Catholic, though he is in utter defiance of almost all of the most important parts of Catholic doctrine. He even pooed his pants in front of the Pope in the Vatican in what was described as a wardrobe incident, but was, well, quite a wardrobe incident, I can tell you from factotums who were present at the time. Biden claims to be a Christian. Why did he choose Easter Sunday to declare Trans Visibility Day? I have no idea, unless it is because he thinks that he's already lost the election in November. Or unless he knows that meaningfully there isn't going to be an election in November. Unless he knows something the rest of us don't know, this studied insult to the Christian community in the United States is likely to be the final nail in his coffin. Now, King Charles was out in public today. May he live a long life. He's receiving treatment for cancer of an indeterminate nature. We don't know if he's got 6 weeks, 6 years, 16 years still to reign over us, but we hope for the best for him. Our darling, Princess Kate, was unable to appear. She was power walking with her husband at a garden center just a weekend or so ago. And then we saw a rather stilted video of her, which many have claimed, I'm not qualified even to begin to take a guess on the veracity of their claims, was not actually all that it was cracked up to be, and that AI and the rest had been deployed. I have no idea about that. But I was very much looking forward to seeing her today make the short walk that the far older King Charles, with his cancer, was able to make, and to sit on the pew next to him. I hope it will not be delayed, that we get to see this marvelous, wonderful young mother and the future queen of this land in public again soon. There's going to be a lot of talk about Palestine tonight, but that doesn't mean that we have forgotten the situation in Ukraine. This marks the last day of the presidency of Volodymyr, as he now has it, Zelensky. His presidential term runs out at midnight tonight. He's not under anesthesia as the other turbulent priest that the West would quite like to be seeing the back of, Mr. Netanyahu, but he is on his last day of his legitimate presidency of his country. He has, of course, banned the election, so we have no idea what will happen next in Ukraine, except this: that when women including pregnant women, when young men, including boys, are being thrown as good money after bad into the maw of this horrific war in Ukraine, which should never have been fought, which did not need to have been fought. We know that things are going badly for Zelensky's army, and everyone knows it, though some continue to throw sand in your eyes in the hope of deceiving you. We're still sending the billions. We're still sending the weapons. We're still pretending that everything is hunky-dory in Ukraine's counter-offensive against a much superior adversary in the forces of the Russian Federation. It's high time to bring about a negotiated end to this conflict. And I, when Parliament returns, am going to be pressing hard through every method I can adduce for this conflict now to come to a negotiated end. If the West does not allow ex-President Zelensky, pro tem, interim, or whatever we're now going to call him, now that his presidency has run out. If the West does not allow Zelensky to conclude a negotiated end to this conflict, not only will they doom hundreds of thousands more Ukrainians to an early grave, they'll be proving that they never cared anything about Ukrainians at all in the first place. Imagine that. It's going to be the mother of all talk shows. Stay tuned.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, Lara El Borno is a Palestinian-American international lawyer, an activist, and co-host of the Palestine Pod. She has been one of the most popular guests on the Mother of All Talk Shows over the last 6 months, and I'm glad to say she joins me again this evening. Lara, thank you for doing that. I ask you this in your lawyer capacity. I've asked you it before. You cautioned me or counseled me to await developments, but developments there have been none. The ICC has still not charged a single person in Israel for what the ICJ said was plausibly the crime of genocide, the ultimate crime in the human canon of law. The ICJ gave Israel 30 days to report back on progress made to the summary demands that the court made on the Israeli government. But if they ever did get back to them, and I'm unaware if they did or they didn't, absolutely nothing has happened as a result of Israel's patent, transparent, not failure, but refusal to implement the demands of the court. And lastly, if you like, the last bit of the lipstick drawn on the pig of the international legal system, the Security Council decided, with no votes against, to demand a ceasefire in the Gaza conflict. And again, ceasefire has been there none. So to what extent are we all, especially you as an international lawyer, to what extent are we all just wasting our time imagining that there is any system of international law.
Well, thank you again for having me, George. I think it's important for us to keep in mind that the law on its own is not going to lead us to freedom. We need every state that has relations with Israel at this moment to sanction Israel with urgency. What we need is efforts by those with power to use their power to put pressure on Israel in order to force it to comply with its international obligations, obligations which you've summarized very clearly, the obligation to comply with the 6 provisional measures that were ordered by the International Court of Justice in January, which Israel has violated every single day since then. And by the way, the International Court of Justice ordered even new provisional measures on March 28th, which barely have been spoken about, ordering Israel to ensure the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza as a result of what the court considered were new circumstances on the ground. In other words, the starvation in Gaza caused by Israel's policy and its continued violations of international law. So it's really important for us to keep in mind that while these developments are taking place in the legal sphere, in these international institutions, in and of themselves, they're not going to force Israel to comply with its international obligations so long as Israel continues to have the full support and backing of the United States, which has affirmed time and again that for Israel, there are no red lines. And so then it falls on all the rest of us to use whatever power we have in order to force Israel to comply. And that means full sanctions on Israel as of right now. That's exactly what we need. I mean, we had at the end of February, we had dozens of UN experts come out and say that any transfer of weapons to Israel for use in Gaza must cease immediately. That was the end of February. And since then, countries have continued to send weapons to Israel, including the United States, which just a few days ago approved new weapons transfers to Israel, including 1,800 2,000-pound bombs, which, by the way, these particular bombs can kill people 300 meters away and were the focus of South Africa's complaint before the ICJ when it argued that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. And the U.S. continues to send the exact same weapons which are allowing Israel to carry out this genocide. So I have to remind people, it falls on us. The enforcement aspect of all of international law falls on those with power to force Israel to comply with its international obligations.
So all these allied governments of Israel, your government, my government, in the vanguard, although Germany also Germany is in fact the second largest contributor of lethal military aid to Israel after the United States. These governments, Germany, Britain, America, they are all acting in flagrant denial and contempt for the very international institutions that they themselves are members of, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we see this time and again. I mean, if you look at just the U.S.'s response, for example, to the U.N. Security Council resolution, they went on a media campaign arguing that the resolution was not binding. But this is like arguing that the sky is not blue. There's not a single international law expert, that's worth, mention who would agree with that position. Article 25 of the UN Charter is crystal clear that the resolutions of the UN Security Council are binding. And yet we see the US time and again create arguments so that it can find a way out for Israel in order to shield Israel from any accountability so that Israel can persist in its violations. And this is an extremely dangerous approach, because what it does is it undermines the entire system of international law, this entire framework that has been established post-World War II, precisely in order to prevent mass atrocities like genocide. And so, yes, of course, the U.S. is in violation of its own obligations. It's complicit in this genocide. It has an obligation under the Genocide Convention not only to not be complicit, but also to prevent genocide and through every single one of its actions, by continuing to fund Israel, by continuing to provide it with the weapons necessary to carry out this genocide, and in general, by shielding it diplomatically on the international stage, by having vetoed two previous UN Security Council resolutions, it is in violation of all of those obligations.
Now, the British government is in trouble today as a result of leaked audio of a minister admitting to a private audience of Conservative Party members that the government's own lawyers had in writing advised them that Israel was in breach of multiple international laws, and that, I'm paraphrasing now, I don't know if she said this, but it follows as night follows day, that therefore the British government is acting illegally in continuing to give weapons, to have intelligence cooperation in a secret military protocol that it has made with Israel, which it will not publish, will not show even to elected members of parliament like me, and that ipso facto, British government ministers are now open themselves to prosecution for military and intelligence cooperation with a country which its own lawyers have decreed to be in breach of the law.
Yeah, I mean, George, this really just exposes the continuing double standards and hypocrisy that are really at play and really form the foundation of U.S. and U.K. policy and the policy of, you know, Western governments more broadly when it comes to Israel, when it comes to the Palestinian struggle for freedom. They will adopt any approach, any arguments necessary to allow them to sustain their support for Israel and to, you know, allow them to continue to undermine Palestinian rights. And this is the unfortunate reality that we deal with as Palestinians who continue after for over seven decades now to struggle for our freedom. And you know, I have to remind that you know, it's really important for us not to lose sight of the fact that at the heart of it, the Palestinian struggle is one for freedom. And Israel's biggest violation of Palestinian rights is its violation of the right of 14 million Palestinians worldwide to self-determination, to determine our own futures collectively as a people on our own land. And, you know, I think we get caught up in like this current moment, this genocide, accountability for this genocide, what will that look like? But we have to remember that this genocide is taking part within this context of over 75 years of apartheid, of ethnic cleansing, of occupation, of settler colonialism, and that the only way to redress all of the violations that are encapsulated in this very oppressive framework that Palestinians live under is freedom. You know, enforcing and allowing Palestinians the right to self-determination, which is our right, by the way, but it's been violated for decades. And that needs to stop. That is the only way to end this conflict.
If a man from Mars landed now, I suspect the first question he would ask is the question, why? Why are all these Western governments uniquely ready to collaborate in crimes against humanity, which are crimes even in their own country, which leave themselves open to prosecution as accessories after the fact of those crimes? Why are they prepared to bend, break any law, any convention, any figment of righteousness? Why, for this little country, 7-8 million people on the Mediterranean, thousands of miles away from themselves, why, Lara?
Well, you look, there's a lot of scholars who've written a lot about this subject who can probably articulate this better than me. But I think, you know, what I can say about this is that Palestine really reveals that we continue to live in a very colonial reality. That, you know, Israel is a U.S. military outpost in the Middle East, that Israel secures and safeguards U.S. interests in the Middle East, and whether that is just in terms of the influence that the U.S. can, you know, yield in the Middle East through Israel's presence or through things like resource theft. We all know that there are hundreds of billions of dollars of gas off of the coast of Gaza, which has been unexplored now for decades, and which just a few weeks into this current genocidal assault, Israel awarded gas exploration licenses to four of the largest gas companies in the world, including BP. And that took place in parallel with this genocidal assault. And nobody even stopped to question whether Israel had the right to do this, whether it even had the right to the very resources that it was awarding gas exploration licenses for, right? So, you know, it's a combination of all of these things, the resource theft, the you know, the influence, the power. And unfortunately, although many people, you know, like to believe that we live in this post-colonial reality, I think Palestine has revealed for us that we certainly do not. And I've heard a lot of people talk about how there's been an unveiling in this moment, how many of the values that we thought that the countries that we lived in actually espoused, we actually realize they don't espouse those values because of the how we've seen those countries position themselves with respect to this genocide. And so it's on us to continue to do everything that we can to struggle for a better world, a better future, one where people are free.
Well, I know that you will, so will I. And let's talk again as this situation, this story develops. Lara Albono, always a pleasure to see you on the Mother
of All
Talk Show.
Thank you, George. And congratulations.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you. Thank you very much, Lara. Who would be the UK's best Prime Minister? Rishi Sunak, Keir Starmer, or me, yours truly? 54,000 people have now voted on this poll. Now, let me take a quick break. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Now, an old friend of mine, a frequent guest of mine, and an authority of global significance on the Israel-Palestine issue is Miko Peled. His father was a general in the Israeli army. Miko Peled himself served in the Israeli army. But now, and for a long time, he's been in the army of justice, shedding light on the criminal nature of the apartheid state of Israel. And I'm glad, and you should be too, that he's back on the Mother of All Talk Shows this evening. Miko, first of all, I have the melancholy duty of inquiring as to the health of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Are you able to enlighten us in any way?
First of all, first things first, I haven't congratulated you yet on your victory in the election. So not for personally anyway, not like this. So you've given, first of all, so congratulations. You've given hope to a lot of people in communities of conscience that have given up on the political, on their own political systems here and everywhere. So it's wonderful to see you back in parliament. As to Netanyahu's, I don't know anything more than anybody else. No, I think that if we're talking about his mental health, I think that's something for experts to examine, because clearly he's a genocidal maniac. But other than that, I really don't know. I can't. There's nothing more that that I know.
Well, let's speculate. Sometimes people don't wake up from anesthesia. Sometimes operations go wrong. Sometimes the patient fades away at a man of his age after surgery, which must have been a very rapid one because we haven't heard anything about the imminence of it until he was already under the anesthetic. Let's speculate. I pointed out at the beginning of the show that if he were not to wake up or not to be able to continue as Prime Minister, it really wouldn't make very much difference because all of the gang around him are at least as bad as he is. Am I right in that?
Yes, I mean, he basically created a political structure that has no that has done away with an opposition. There's no opposition. So, you know, when the Senator Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, spoke in the Senate, when was it, last week or something, calling for Israeli elections, you thought, what would be the point of that, number one? I mean, they're all the same. They're all in the same boat. They've always all agreed on the issue of Palestine. There's never been any dissent one way or the other. And there's nobody else to vote for because everybody has been either a prime minister or a minister of defense or a minister of something else in Netanyahu's government over time. So there's really no other option to vote for. So might as well go with Netanyahu, because at the end of the day, he's, even when he loses the election, he's the only one that's capable of putting together a coalition, which is really the magic. The magic is not winning or getting the most votes in Israeli politics. It's knowing how to, you know, thread a coalition together. And there's nobody who does it better than him. And I say this again, you probably remember, I mean, there were times where he actually, his party did not have the most votes. And yet, because they were not able to put together a coalition, he ended up being the prime minister because he was able to make the deals. He's the best horse trader. He's the best politician in Israeli, in the Israeli political sphere. And, you know, like I said, if it was somebody else, and like you said, it would really make no difference whatsoever on the outcome, certainly not when it comes to the Palestinians.
I'm a believer that just as a surgeon cannot operate on his own foot, neither can we expect any significant change from inside Israel itself. For the reasons you have adumbrated, but also because of the disappearance of huge parts of the Israeli political movements, Yesh Gavul and movements for justice of all kinds, which were once in their tens of thousands in Israel. I used to hang out with them in Shankin Street in Tel Aviv, just off the beach. I have fond memories of it. But they now live in Lisbon. They now live in Paris. They live in the United States. Or they have somehow lost the will to fight. Now, the vast majority of Israelis believe in the annihilation of the Palestinian people in Gaza. That's the sorry truth, isn't it?
Yes, I think one more reason that Netanyahu is still relevant is because he's doing exactly what his voters want him to do. They want him to hit. And I remember, you know, I remember people saying this years and years ago. Long before there was a siege, there's always been a siege, in fact, but long before the official siege on Gaza, we need to get in there and just wipe them all out. We need to just wipe. And this was not coming from extremists. This was not coming from fanatics. This was just people talking. Just people talking. We need to get in there and flatten the place and just kill all of them. And I would wonder, who are these, you know, where does this come from? And so you're right. This is the legitimate discourse on every level, in the press, on the television, in the street. When you look at the social media, you know, some of the just a casual, you know, popular social media platforms, people posting their own stuff, not necessarily the propaganda, but just the common things that people post. The discourse is just so horrific and racist. And I think I've said this to you before. I've never compared what Israel has done to the Nazis or to the Holocaust, but now it's just so obvious. The discourse, the racism, the what they're doing in Gaza. I mean, this mass killing of civilians. They become Nazis, or maybe they're always Nazis, and now this has brought it out into the open. But this is, I think, how we need to start talking about it, so that the world understands. In the break earlier, there was a thing about you talking about the need to boycott and how it works. People need to understand why boycotting Israel is so important, why sanctions against Israel is so important, because they're like Nazis now. They're behaving and speaking like Nazis. It's time they need to pay a price. They need to be stopped.
It is literally a genocidal project, isn't it? If the definition of genocide is to extirpate, either through annihilation or transfer or mass deportation out of their own land, from their own property, out of the country altogether. I mean, no one could dispute that that is Israel's policy and what Israel is right now doing in Gaza.
That's true. And people think that genocide is, you know, rounding people up and putting them in ovens or you know, gassing people. Genocide, the definition of the crime of genocide has many aspects to it. And when you take it, and I've done this out of just because I was curious, when you look at the definition of the crime of genocide and you juxtapose it with what has been happening in Palestine the last 76, 80 years, 75, 76 years, it's almost like somebody in the Zionist organizations took a piece of paper and just wanted to put a check mark next to each and every item that defines genocide. Because it's not just about the people. It's not just about the killing. It's about the mass deportation. It's about the destruction of the country. It's about the destruction of a culture and the destruction of a history or the erasure of the history and so on. So there are several aspects to what genocide actually means. And they have checked each and every box as though by intentionally. And so we've got the intent, obviously, which is made obvious by their actions. We have the intent, which we hear all the time in their speech and what people are saying. And not only today, going back 75 years. I mean, the intent to destroy Palestinians, get rid of Palestinians is nothing new. It's just that it has a slightly different character today. And so we have a genocidal regime that the world allowed to, you know, commence its genocide. So just 3 years after the end of the genocide of the Jews in Europe, just after the end of the Holocaust, they allowed this genocide to begin in Palestine. And you wonder, well, at what point are people going to wake up and say, well, genocide is genocide, and it's time to stop it, and it's time to treat it like genocide. So I always argue with people who are calling for ceasefire, because ceasefire is not the appropriate, and it is not the appropriate response to genocide. And Israel has signed how many, you know, ceasefire agreements since the initial ceasefire of 1949, of January, February 1949, which basically established the borders of the state of Israel and eliminated the Palestinians from any process, because these agreements were signed with the countries that border Palestine, but nothing with Palestinians. And ever since then, and of course, those are violated very, very quickly. And ever since then, Israel has violated every agreement. So this is the reality. And this is something that Israelis have always voted for. Israeli society have always agreed with this, with very few exceptions.
So we, just as we know why the scorpion stings, because it's a scorpion, we know why colonists believe and behave rather towards those they have colonized, because they are colonists. The bigger question for me, asked this of Lara Alborno earlier, and she couldn't really answer, and I can't answer. Maybe you can. If a man from Mars arrived and looked at the situation, he would not be puzzled by why the Israeli settler state is doing what it's doing. But he might be questioning of why all these other Western governments are prepared to disrupt their own interests, their own friendships and alliances and even prosperity for the sake of that little colonizing power. They didn't do it to maintain French colonial power in Algeria. They didn't even do it to maintain French or subsequently American colonial power in Vietnam. Why are they ready, it seems, to break themselves on the wheel of Israeli exceptionalism, Israeli supremacism? Genuinely puzzles me that, Miko.
It's a very, very important question. And the Zionists have learned from all these other experiences that you've mentioned and others. And for the past 100 years, they have invested heavily in creating relationships and developing an influence with education systems, not only in America, but certainly in Britain and in other countries in Europe, with investing and developing relationships with the press, in all the different cultural spheres in every country in the West, certainly with politicians and the political process, so that when people are raised in, you know, Western democracies, or, you know, generally in the West, although not exclusively, because this is true in Latin America, and to a large degree, it's true in Africa as well, people are raised to be Zionists, even if they don't realize it. The Zionist education is prevalent and exists across the board everywhere. The reason everybody is a Zionist is because that is what they see. It's what they see in all aspects of culture. It's what they learn in all levels of their education system. It's what is in movies and in literature. It's what's in the press mostly. So people are genuinely, I think, Zionists, even if they don't understand, if they don't realize it. Now, on top of that, there has never been anything even remotely similar to present the Palestinian story, the Palestinian case. Doesn't exist. Here in America, I know for a fact, half the people you talk to, if you say Palestine, they confuse it with Pakistan. And then beyond that, the people who do know that there's a Palestine know absolutely nothing about it. So when somebody becomes decides to become a politician and runs for office, this is the baggage they bring. So for them to support Israel is completely natural. It actually makes perfect sense for politicians in the West to be pro-Israeli, because that's all they know. That's all they've ever learned. And it's true for the public, too. So suddenly we come up and we say you have to boycott Israel. And they say, you want to boycott the only Jewish state, the only democracy in the Middle East? You must be anti-Semitic. There's no context. They don't know what you and I know. They have not been educated in this way. So why would they possibly not support Israel? I think actually the support for Israel in the West, and again, like I said, Latin America is very, very strong, and in Africa it's very, very strong now, is perfectly normal. It's perfectly natural. What we need to do is we need to double our efforts, because we have the truth, we have history, and we have international law on our side. And we need to double our efforts so that what we're seeing in the street, what we're seeing in the popular support for Palestine, which always existed, we need to find the way to elevate it so that it enters the halls of power, so that it enters the boardrooms of the press and the boardrooms of the, you know, people who create culture and popular culture and so forth. We have not made that transition. And until we do, we're not going to see different results, because the education is basically a Zionist education, a pro-Israel education, and it's very, very deep. It's fundamental.
I was reading something today about the demise of, they went down fighting, but they did suffer the demise of the Comanche people, of original Americans, finally wiped out by the New Mexican militias and the 7th Cavalry and all the rest of the paraphernalia of the American settler state. And my son asked me, Daddy, what's a Comanche? In other words, the Comanche are in the museum. They are something that old men like me read about. Arafat always said, maybe even said it to you, he said it to me 1,000 times, we are not the Red Indians, he would say. We're not going to go into the museum of X nations like the Comanche. Sometimes one loses hope that this can all be reversed, but it is, hope is returned by the absolute determination of the Palestinian people themselves not to go into that museum. Do you feel that?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, people ask me all the time, what keeps you going? What inspires you? And I'm like, what do you mean what inspires me? Look at the Palestinian people. Look at the people in Gaza. How can you not be inspired? And I think this is also in the break. I mean, your voice was saying we don't have the luxury to lose our let our spirit down. How could we possibly lose hope when we see the Palestinian people and their accomplishments and their spirit and their not just their desire to life, but the dignity that they maintain under such horrific, horrific conditions? They're subjected now to such horrors that are even unprecedented in the Palestinian experience. And yet you look at the children, you look at the, you talk to the people, you speak to elderly women, you see the strength, you hear a woman, you know, talk about her six children being killed. And yet with all the sadness, there's this dignity that's been maintained. And, you know, our only wish, of course, is that more people would see this so that they understand what we're talking about. We're talking about a nation of people who are unique in their ability to maintain their dignity and to keep their spirit alive. And that's, of course, that's what inspires, I think, all of us that keep going, that connection with those people. And it also maintains our, not just our hope that it's possible, but our desire to do everything we possibly can to see the suffering end, to see this apartheid dismantled, to see a free democratic Palestine where these people can live and go back to their lands and worship where they want to worship and live the way they want to live and raise these beautiful, beautiful, sweet children. So that is, of course, without a doubt, the biggest source of hope and inspiration and also the drive to get this done and to end this suffering once and for all with a political solution that is you know, permanent.
Palestine is the moral center of the world, isn't it? Bush famously said, you're either with us or against us. That same dichotomy exists on Palestine. You are either in favor of those committing genocide or you're on the side of those suffering it. It's quite simple. They try to make out as if it's complicated, Miko, but it's actually a common or garden case of white European colonization, extirpation of the native, like they did in Tasmania successfully. They have not been able to do to the Palestinians, and that's their problem, isn't it?
Yes, sir. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I have a good friend, a Jewish elderly gentleman, activist who lives here in the United States, and he says, "Well, I reject racism. What's your perspective? You know, where do you stand?" Yeah, there's no other place to stand. You either support genocide or you oppose genocide. It's very, very simple. And when you realize, once people do realize that the genocide began with the inception of the State of Israel, with the creation of the State of Israel, then that makes it even more simple, because if you understand what the source of the problem is, what the source of the violence is, you need to dismantle that and to allow something better to take its place. And that's really what we're talking about. One process to dismantle the apartheid regime, which is responsible for the violence and is perpetuating the genocide. And on the other, to start building this hopeful vision, creating, seeing this vision materialize of a free democratic Palestine with equal rights, and putting in mechanisms, putting in place real mechanisms to allow the refugees to return. So this is very, very simple, actually. You don't have to invent the wheel. It's been done before. And then this will, without any question, allow the people who live in historic Palestine, whether they're Jews or Muslims or Christians, and so on, or whoever, to live in peace, to live a normal life, finally. This is the remedy. This is the magic pill, if you will.
Well, it is Easter. We can hope for resurrection indeed. Thank you, Miko Peled, for, as always, a dazzling tour d'horizon. Miko Peled, Israeli author and activist. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Who would be UK's best prime minister, Sunak, Starmer, or me? Well, the poll has closed. 57,512 people have voted. On Telegram, 1% said Rishi Sunak, 1% said Keir Starmer, and 98% said me. On Twitter, 4% said Rishi Sunak, 7% said Keir Starmer, and 89% said me. On YouTube community, 3% said Rishi Sunak, 2% said Keir Starmer, and 95% said George Galloway. And on the YouTube stream, it was 2, 3, and 95. 59,099 people voted. So over the next couple of days, that will rise over the 60,000 mark. Not scientific, but a big poll and a pretty big win. Andrew Holt says, I wish you could come to Walsall, West Midlands, and get somebody as an MP. I don't know where to vote for anymore. I can't vote for Labour and have never voted Tory. Andrew, we'll be there in Walsall and throughout the West Midlands. Trust me on that. You'll have somebody to vote for. And Omar Rana says, many Jews all over the world support Palestine. Much love to all of them. Amen to that, Omar. What might be the last call of the evening? Sean in London on Palestine. Go ahead, Sean.
Evening, Mr. Galloway. First of all, congratulations on the monumental win in Rochdale. Congratulations to the people of Rochdale for having someone of your caliber in their corner. My question, I'll keep it short, is I've recently re-listened to a podcast that Mr. Netanyahu was on. It's the Lex Friedman podcast. About 40 minutes in, he starts talking about peace in the Middle East. And it's a very worrying situation because essentially I'm getting the sense that he has so much faith in the fact that the Israelis have such good relations with the majority of the Arabic world. But then when you see the protests in the streets, it seems that the people are not in the same sort of mentality. So how does this end? Because essentially, I'm praying that we're going to see that kind of Arab Springs. That
you're frightened, Sean. I'm hoping for. Either the Arab rulers are going to have to change their attitude, or the people will change them. I'm in no doubt that we are in the beginning of a new Arab Spring. It will be called the Gaza Spring. When I see the scale of the demonstrations in Jordan, for example, and in Cairo, where it is possible, as it was at an iftar the other night in downtown Cairo, I study Egyptian affairs and developments extremely closely, and at football stadia and so on, where the regime can do nothing about the huge mass of the people gathered there, it's undoubtedly the case that the Arab masses are moving. The tectonic plates in the Arab world are shifting. And some rulers, like the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, are moving their country's position for fear of that kind of development affecting their country. In fact, the Crown Prince said, I think today, that the radicalization of the youth of Arabia as a result of these crimes that they are all seeing, no one can stop them from seeing, is a threat to stability and a threat to economic progress and diversification and all the plans that he has. And so he is adjusting at least the rhetoric that he uses towards the Israelis, towards the issues of so-called normalization and so on. But if these rulers don't move their position, they'll be overthrown by their own masses, because the mass of the Arab world, all the way from the Atlantic right to the Persian Gulf, is unequivocal and overwhelming. And in the end, when the people are united, they can never be defeated. Sean, great call. There is one last call. It's Danny in Liverpool, and I do want to take it. Danny, welcome to the show.
Hi there, George. Big congrats for winning in Rochdale. I'm just down the road, as you know, in Liverpool. I've been watching your show now for a good few weeks, and, you know, it's pretty, for once, intelligent, you know, an intelligent debate, what I'm hearing. And one of the questions I want to throw to you is, like, circa around about 2010, the great rise in either extreme left and extreme right in politics now, there doesn't seem to be any reasonable centre ground like they used to be in our politics here in the UK, but also across the greater West. You know, Western civilization, in my view, seems to be that of either you're in 100% in one camp or 100% in the other, and to have a voice in the middle anymore, you're essentially quashed, you know. And one kind of like interesting thing that comes to mind was back when you were hauled in front of the US Senate just after, I think, the end of the Iraq War, you know, some of the baseless kind of accusations they were throwing at you back then, and you were right all along then, you know, just as you're right all along now. And, if a few more people had have listened to you, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, beautiful, Danny. Beautiful. I'm grateful for it. I'm sorry to cut you short, but I'm already over the hour. Let me just tell you two stats. Little Soldier Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, is disapproved of by 73% of the German voters. And Bonkers Baerbock is almost as heavily disapproved of. 73%. Little Macron has a disapproval rating of 72%, just 1 point less disastrous than little Scholz. The great majority of people in the United States disapprove of the performance of President Joe Biden. I don't think they would even bother polling in Britain to find out what percentage of the British people disapproved of little Rishi Sunak. Just ponder that. 1, 2, 3, 4 of the most significant Western countries are ruled by politicians whom the vast majority of their own electorate feel nothing but contempt for them, despise them, and would have them out, will have them out, just as soon as they get the opportunity to do so. The centre cannot hold. The centre is a busted flush. Everybody knows that the politics of globalised capitalism, the WEF, the Bill Gates, the George Soros, and so on, is designed to beggar them. Everyone has already tumbled to that truth. Everyone believes that these so-called centrist governments and all of those four governments, and you could add in blackface Justin Trudeau, there's five. You could add in many more, I'm sure. Everybody knows that these governments do not serve their interests and that these governments have no project, have no plan that can remotely be described as a plan likely to succeed. They are doubling down on failure, reinforcing failure, throwing good money after bad, and everybody knows it. The problem is, in many countries, there is not yet in place a project that can, if taken at the flood, lead to good fortune for the mass of the people, particularly in the United States. I'm here in Britain, and there are others like me who will seek to give the British people the opportunity of taking that sea of contempt for the centrist, globalist politicians, to take that flood to good fortune. In France, there is a person like me called Jean-Luc Mélenchon. In Germany, there is now a person like me, Sarah Wagenknecht and her new party in Germany. We are the future. I'm a bit old to fully devote the time that's necessary, 20 years or so, that will be able to steer our countries forward. But our main problem is that in the United States, it is a desert, a political desert. There's no one like me, like Mélenchon, like Wagenknecht, in the United States. There will have to be some genuine leader who's not in hock to all the forces of wickedness and evil in the world will have to emerge and will have to come to power in the United States if humanity is to thrive, if humanity is even to survive. It's been marvelous for me. I hope it was for you. It's been a great show, I think, with two top guests. And the good news is that, God willing, I'll be back on Wednesday at the same time, from the same place. It's the mother of all talk shows. Thanks for watching.